Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
And look at that. The phone seems to be ringing. I'm going to go ahead and pick that up. Hello, do I have you online?
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi. Who's this?
This is Randa. Hi.
Hi, Randa.
I wrote you a couple of emails explaining that I'm a 77-year-old woman. I'm healthy. I don't take any meds. I'm in good shape. And all my blood work comes back fine, except I have low platelet count.
Oh, you're the low platelet lady. Yeah, I've got you. I've got you right here.
Good.
Okay. So, and you apparently had I'm glad you called because I had some questions after I read your email. So you had a hematology workup, right?
Right.
And did they do a bone marrow biopsy?
No.
Okay. Strike one. And what did they do? Just repeat the blood test or?
Yeah, they did. They did the complete blood counts. They did a test to see if any of my internal organs are being badly affected.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like something like HDL, but it's close to that.
Okay.
And I've had this repeated maybe five times now.
Okay. Have you had any imaging?
No, no imaging. I don't seem to have any bad effects at all.
No, you wouldn't. Not.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to read your letter to bring the audience up to date.
Okay.
Hello, my platelet count is between 40 and 60 instead of 150. And that's the only thing that's wrong with any of my blood work. As you said, healthy, 77-year-old, take no medicines, plenty of energy, no problem with clotting, so basically no bruising, no gum bleeding, anything like that.
Nope.
And between 40 and 60, if those platelets are functioning well, is fine. Actually, sometimes I have people who have their platelets are maybe 600, and they actually are bleeders because they have 600 platelets, but their platelets aren't any good. So their bone marrow keeps turning them out, but they're not working well. And so it's that's just an interesting sideline, not your problem. So the first place, being it's me that you're talking to, the first place I go to is nutrition. And sometimes people have a problem with absorbing B12. So sometimes they have a problem processing B12. So there's like multiple areas where this can go sideways and low B12 or poor B12 activity, and I'll come back to that in a second, can definitely contribute to low platelets. Also iron deficiency, also if you have elevated homocysteine, that can indicate a type of mutation in your folic acid pathway that could lead to low platelets.
So none of those are happening for me. I have plenty of iron. All my hemo numbers are perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I take B12.
Go take a look at your labs and see if they checked a methylmalonic acid or a homocysteine, because those are not part of the standard shoot from the hip test. So write those down. Homocysteine.
Homocysteine I've got. Methylmalonic?
Methylmalonic acid. So
okay.
M-E-T-H-Y-L, malonic,
uh-huh.
M-A-L-O-N-I-C, and acid
right.
I think you can manage on your own. So,
yeah.
So, and I'm assuming all that lovely good behavior of yours that you're not a heavy drinker, but heavy drinkers have to watch out.
No, I don't drink at all. Nutrition is fine.
Mm-hmm.
Really, they couldn't figure out any correlation with anything.
Right. So here's,
I did look up a few things. I've had my COVID vaccinations every 6 months. Sometimes COVID vaccinations can lower the platelet count. And also I had a UTI in December, and sometimes antibiotics can.
Mm-hmm.
So my
when was your last normal? Yeah, when was the normal platelet count that you changed from to this? And how big was the...
About 6 months ago. I never had a problem with platelets.
Okay.
They were always over 150. Yeah.
So one of the things is that urinary tract infection you mentioned, sulfa antibiotics, which are often mm-hmm. used to treat UTIs, will do this.
Right, but I didn't have a sulfa antibiotic,
okay.
So that guess we can worry.
Roll that out. You know, heparin and other blood thinners can do it, but you're not on any of those. The reason I asked about...
No, and she took me off of all my supplements that have any kind of blood clotting effect at all.
Right.
any of the blood thinners. I'm not taking omegas anymore, and I'm a lot of mm-hmm. things.
Okay, so the other things are autoimmune diseases and right. Sequestration, which is, you know, everything we've talked about so far has been either they aren't working right or you're not making them because of some problem in the making end. But there's also something called sequestration, which you probably want an ultrasound to see if your spleen is enlarged, certainly if it persists, because people can get, for example, you can get mononucleosis even as an adult, and you can get a large spleen from it. And if your platelets will, the spleen will soak up platelets like a big sponge, and it's called sequestration. And so we just need to make sure that your spleen has not gotten enlarged for some reason.
Okay, and would that be palpable? I mean, I've had...
In adults, it's often not palpable even when it's enlarged. Okay. So an ultrasound, you know, by a professional ultrasound is the cheapest way to go. And if your spleen is big, then that might be something to follow up with more sophisticated imaging. And it might just be how you are going to be, but I think there's an X factor because it... And it could be an infection that, like, silent COVID could do it. I guess COVID vaccine. I hadn't heard that COVID vaccine can do it, but it almost seems like anything that COVID can do, the vaccine can do a little bit.
Yeah, right.
A little bit.
Well, she wants me to take dexamethasone for a high dose of dex for 4 days, and I really don't want to do that since I am healthy, and I don't really want to screw up my immune system. So
right. Well, I think you can do some watchful waiting. I presume she's making the presumption that this is autoimmune.
Yes.
And
that's what she said.
So it's like, well, did you actually find any autoimmune antibodies? Did you have antibody testing? That would be anti-nuclear antibody, anti-CCP antibody. You could go look at your labs and see if those are there.
Okay.
And that might be a woman postmenopausal. You know, we're the ones, we get a lot of autoimmune disease. It's probably because we're just more pro-inflammatory as we're older. And we've had kids, many of us. And boys or girls?
I have three girls.
Okay. Your children don't share your DNA, right? They share half your DNA.
Right.
And what happens is during pregnancy, cells from the embryo and the fetus, for that matter, pass through the placenta, and they actually lodge in the mother's bone marrow. We can find them, and now with our sophisticated testing. So a lot of the lore about mothers, you know, feeling their children's when they're in trouble and stuff, I guess a little bit believer that we haven't discovered everything there is to know about human energetics, but the fact that you actually have your daughter's cells, all three of them, in your bone marrow, means that you've got an irritant when it comes to autoimmune. You've got foreign DNA in your bone marrow. And maybe that explains, again, it's hypothetical. We don't have the definitive answer. But there is a statistical bias towards autoimmune disease that's higher in women who are paras, that is to say, who have actually carried a pregnancy to term.
That's so interesting
little, you know, support for this idea. But, you know, you're not going to unhave your babies to avoid autoimmune disease. They're worth way more than this small increased risk. But, you're going to need to track it. And if you choose not to use the steroids, you'll have to be very alert for unusual bleeding. And I would, you know, I don't know what the regulations say, but I'd be getting a CBC every couple of months and looking at the platelets.
I'm getting them every 2 weeks.
Well,
she just wants me, if it goes below 30, then she wants me to start on the dex. And meanwhile, between the 40 and 60 that I've been bouncing up and down for months now, she said, it's okay, just wait.
Yeah. Well, I kind of agree with if you're showing a downward vector from where you are, you don't have much margin.
Right.
And you don't know, you know, I don't want to put a ghost in your head, but I will just say there's several ghosts that could be in your head that might bleed if the platelets get too low, not to mention all these other places, like, you know, that blood vessel that's kind of exposed in your back of your stomach that you don't even know about because it doesn't cause any symptoms.
Right. There could be many places to bleed from. You're right.
Just okay. About anywhere. So stay on it. And as far as steroids are concerned, if you're just floating between 40 and 60, you could sit tight. I'd probably check those specific things I mentioned and get the ultrasound. Right. I think they haven't looked under that particular rug yet with the spleen enlargement.
Okay, so I'll check that out. I appreciate it.
No, appreciate you're welcome. Your help.
Thanks
obviously, you really wanted to talk to me, so here we are.
Yes, I did. Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go on to a little bit of an amusing story here. And this may be the first practical joke ever played on artificial intelligence. It's called Bixonomania, and it's a fake disease invented by researchers to examine artificial intelligence and its ability to utilize information in medical and healthcare applications. The disorder, with symptoms of sore eyes and darkening around them, periorbital hyperpigmentation, they called it in the paper, is supposedly caused by blue light from screens. The experiment was conducted by a team from the University of Gothenburg, led by Almira Osmanovic Thunstrom. Many steps were taken to ensure that any person who read the paper actually could tell it was not a real condition. The team chose an obviously inappropriate name ending in mania, which is a description used only in psychiatry. The lead author was noted as belonging to Asteria Horizon University, located in Nova City, California, neither of which exist. An acknowledgement was made to, get this, Professor Maria Baum at the Starfleet Academy for her kindness and generosity in contributing with her knowledge and her lab on board the USS Enterprise. The name was first used in a blog posted on Medium titled, How Many People Suffer from Bixonomania? Shortly thereafter, a more scholarly-looking paper describing it was posted later in April 2024 on a preprint server with several fake authors. Then a second paper was posted in May. That would be May of 2024. By 2026, AI chatbots were routinely suggesting Bixonomania based on the list of symptoms provided. Thunstrom and her team discovered that many large language models processed the information and gave it as health advice. Microsoft Copilot declared, Bixonomania is indeed an intriguing and relatively rare condition, while Gemini gave the information that Bixonomania is a condition caused by excessive exposure to blue light. In fact, three Indian researchers published a research paper that cited the preprint on the fake disease in Curious, a peer-reviewed journal published by Springer Nature. It was subsequently retracted. Following the revelations in a news article in Nature describing the experiment, several AI systems began to generate corrective input. So that's the greatest April Fool's Day joke on AI I've ever seen. Oh, looks like we've got a call coming in, so I'm going to go ahead and pick that up. Hello, you're on the air with Dr. Don. Hello. What's your name and where are you calling from?
John, Santa Cruz.
John in Santa Cruz. Okay, John, how can I help?
I have a question. First off, if it's applied right, do you believe intermittent fasting can be a benefit?
Yes. That's easy.
And, okay. And then currently, I fast maybe one day per week, sometimes 2 days per week. Would it be more beneficial to keep that sort of pattern or go for a longer fast and a longer spread out time period?
How old are you?
75.
Don't fast for more than a day.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, you can't really afford to lose muscle mass. And so when you say fast, are we talking just a water fast? Do you allow yourself juices? Do you allow yourself oils like medium chain triglycerides? It'll help you get into ketosis, which is really what you want. But, you know, we want to eat the broken up protein, not the good stuff in the muscles.
Oh, okay. excuse me. I usually do water. And it doesn't come because I'm concentrating, I'm going to fast today. Mm-hmm. It just, I don't eat all day.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no tendency to be hungry.
Yeah. I think you probably want to start monitoring your muscle mass. There's a test called bioimpedance analysis that I do. I do it in my office, but there are a lot of scales that will do a kind of so-so thing. And there are, I think there's health clubs where if you're a member, you can use their in-body scale anytime you want. The thing about those scales is because they don't have, they rely on the conductivity of your skin. You don't want to be dehydrated and you don't want to be sweaty because that'll mess with the results. You want like...
Right. I used to have a bioimpedance machine and I tried out both scale and then this one where it hooked up to the biceps and then another remote spot. And I found that the scale was just too all over the place. I couldn't get a consistent reading.
Yeah, well, the hydration is key. And
yeah.
So, and time of day as well, because our bodies have our fluid has a circadian rhythm. What else? What doesn't? So you have to do the same time of day, and you have to have had about the same amount of hydration. And it's fuzzy. It's like that, you know, that sleep monitor that many people wear, where it tells you that you had, you know, 75 minutes of deep sleep, and you know, it means you had somewhere between an hour and an hour and a half. It doesn't have that tight of resolution. However, if you're seeing a steady downward trend, that's a concern. And after the age of 75, you really shouldn't go without protein for more than 24 hours because you will start to catabolize and your muscle protein isn't protected the way it is when you're younger. It's just part of the epigenetic genetic changes that come with aging. It would be safer to simply limit your eating time and sort of say, okay, I'm not hungry. I'm going to start. Let's say you get up at 7 in the morning. So you're going to start, you're going to eat, you're going to have a protein shake or a protein drink, even though you're not hungry, at 10. So now you've got the protein in your body and you're going to go and eat, plan your meal of the day probably 8 hours after that. And then you've got a couple more hours where it's filtering into your system. And you've got 12 hours when you're not eating. And that's plenty for the cleanup job that we're after. You know, the autolysis of the wasted, of the broken proteins. And just, you know, your body will go and eat leftovers when that's all that's around. But if you fast too long, it'll get into the protein cupboard and start attacking your muscle. And that's the hardest thing to do once you've lost it, is rebuild muscle when you're older. It's really hard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was about 10 years ago, I was about, I'm 5'7", and I was about 130 to 135 most of the time. I might vary, in a week, I might vary 1 pound. But if that was a general range, and then about 10 years ago, I lost, I went all the way down to about 115. And no really explainable rationale for it. And then it leveled off at about 115, and I've been that way for the past 10 years.
I'll give you a hint. And okay. The hint, do you do any kind of weightlifting or resistance work?
I did, and that's pretty much it.
No.
I don't have the functional capacity to get out there and do it like I used to.
Well, it's fine, but you probably still have the ability to build back a little bit, and somewhat is better than not at all. So my tip is get some maybe some resistance bands, you know, look at some videos or read some articles, get a book at the library, whatever. But resistance bands are cheap, and between them and a doorknob and a chair, you can do a lot of resistant work. And you're basically looking for what can you do 12 times, and then you need to rest. If you can do it 12 times, then you need to add weight. If you don't need to stop. I'm not done.
Okay.
All right. The other thing is you have to have at least 30 grams of protein in your gut when you do this.
Okay.
So that's where this, you know, giving yourself a big dose of protein, and there needs to be at least 5 grams of what they call branched chain amino acids. And these will, and if they're in the bloodstream circulating when you do the exercise, it'll turn on the muscle building DNA. And this is science fact. There's good studies on this, looking at messenger RNA levels in the bloodstream. It does work. When you're 30, you don't need to do any of that stuff and you'll build muscle. But after 65, probably younger, it's probably a continuum, not a cliff, you start to need to actually have the protein present in the blood at the same time. And you're not, and if you're already catabolizing, you're not going to build. You're not, you know, you're not going to anabolize when you're already in catabolizes. They're black and white, they're state changes, and you can't do both at the same time. So any exercise you do while you're fasting is basically wasted.
Oh, okay. How much protein is in the average large egg? About
7 grams, 7-8 grams, I think.
Okay. So I can measure that. That's good.
There's a good, myfooddata.com has just an amazing amount of information, and they slice it and dice it. You know, foods high in protein, how many protein per serving in, fill in the blank. It has it all right there, myfooddata.com.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your help on the fasting thing. And
Great question. I'm sure many people had that question in mind.
Can you is there another way of getting a type of fast? Let's say an all vegetable, low input, or all beef, or
I need to understand your goals.
Okay.
So.
The goal is to try and put back some of that muscle tissue.
Okay, well then don't fast. Eat protein.
Okay.
And eat, your age is, as you said, but I don't remember. So you eat your age in grams of protein every day.
Okay.
And that'll be a lot of protein in your 70s. But
oh, yeah.
Because you don't break it down as readily, you don't absorb it as readily, and that's as inevitable as the changes in your skin tone that happen in the sun-exposed areas. Well, that's happening to the gut tone in the stomach, in the intestine. It's getting flabby and not working as well, and that's epigenetic change. It happens faster, it happens slower, but it happens.
Oh, yeah. I know the downhill slide from being fit to at the condition I am now, which is not fit. The downhill slide, it's getting steeper. I can feel it.
But you have to fight it, is my point. You can't just sit there and accept it. And, you know, so fasting may not be your right strategy anymore.
Okay.
It really.
Well, I have to force myself to eat.
You will have to force yourself to eat. You can go and smoke some pot, or take gummy, or I can. You know, your doctor can prescribe a nice pharmaceutical that'll give you an appetite. But you know, you probably have some willpower, and drinking it is easiest, in my opinion. If you drink it, you can sort of, you know, if it says mix it with 8 ounces and you mix it with 16, it's thinner. It doesn't really taste much different than water. And you can kind of just pretend, put it in a clear thing and pretend it's water.
Right now I have a lot of won't power instead of willpower.
Well, yes. Well, I can probably suggest some psychologists who can help you with motivation. If you send me an email, I don't want to be recommending people specifically on the air. All right.
Okay.
You can go to AskDrDawn.com and send a message and ask for referrals for motivational assist if you like.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate your help and thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, we are definitely on the spectrum here with our next caller. Hi, this is Dr. Dawn. May I have your name and where you're calling from?
My name is Dave. I'm calling from Santa Cruz.
Well, hello, Dave. from Santa Cruz. How can I help tonight?
Well, I had a recent DEXA scan and came out with osteoporosis. It was a negative T4, something like that.
Do you know the T score? What was it?
Yeah,
negative four?
Negative four, maybe.
Okay,
yeah.
Negative 4.0 is a bad one.
Rather unusual for males.
Yep, it is. It is, but not unheard of for sure. So
what I wanted to ask about is I have tried. My doctor recommended possibly trying pulsed electromagnetic frequency to rebuild. Most of it was centered on my right hip. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know, I've done four of them so far. I'm wondering if there's any side effects or anything harmful to the rest of my body doing that therapy.
No, I don't believe there is. It's considered, it's FDA approved for not going to hurt you. At least safe, not necessarily effective. When I was training in acupuncture many years ago, one of the things they told us was that in using electrical acupuncture, you could put one pin all the way down to the bone and hook that up to the negative and then put another one in a nice big muscle that was going to move. And then you could turn up the juice until the muscle was twitching and leave it there, and that would help rebuild bone. And the idea with bone is actually has a crystal characteristic. When you walk or compress bone, it actually generates a small electric charge. And the cells that lay down the bone matrix, the osteoclasts, blasts, the osteoblasts, B for build, are stimulated by electricity. And they're stimulated by you standing in gravity because of this electrophysiologic phenomenon. And when you put electricity into bone, you're effectively imitating that. And so it should build the osteoblasts up and cause them to put down more bone matrix. The thing that you would want to be doing as well is weight-bearing exercise, not jumping jacks or anything that was high impact, but walking, climbing stairs, upstairs is probably fine. Going downstairs, you'd have to, you can't just pop down the stairs hard would be the thing you wouldn't want to do. But going up is a nice way to build your leg muscles and thigh muscles and butt muscles, as well as stimulating the bones in a pretty safe way. So I would say you can't just lie there and be passive and expect much, but it might goose the process enough so that when you're doing the compression, you get more bang for your buck. And so the other thing to consider, because that is a pretty high level, that's a drug therapy treatable level. And in women, I'm not fond of giving bisphosphonates at the drop of a hat, but in women, if you've got a minus four, I am talking to you about thinking about going on one of these drugs that helps build bone and stabilizes bone. I think it's important. Yeah. Check your vitamin. Have you taken a lot of vitamin D in your life? I got questions here.
Yes. No, I've been, I was up at 5,000, 6,000 a day for a while. About a year ago, my doctor brought me back down to four.
Mm-hmm.
But that was before the osteoporosis. So that.
Well, there's, if you're 6,000 doesn't worry me as much as like 10,000 a day. There was a study that was done a few years back where they gave people were taking 10,000. I think they gave them 400 and they gave them 10,000 for like 3 months, and they saw bone loss in the 10,000 group. And what they think is happening is that when you give too much, it actually turns on the bone breakdown cells. It like activates them inappropriately. So then your osteoclasts, the ones, the little Pac-Man cells that eat the bone, are goosed upwards. And so you lose that balance of building versus breaking down. And so that, I don't know how long you did it, and I really don't know. 3 months is what they did in the study, and they saw bone loss. I don't know where you started out. There's a lot of unknowables in a situation like this. Another possibility is your parathyroid hormone. That definitely needs to be checked. If it hasn't been.
Is that like T1, T2, or 3, or something like that?
No, that's your thyroid hormone.
Parathyroid.
Parathyroid is responsible for taking calcium out of your bones when you need it to buffer acidity in your blood or when you need it for some other purpose. And your kidneys are in charge of that. And the parathyroids, basically, they get a signal from the kidneys to do this. The whole thing is, if your calcium doesn't stay within, it's a very narrow range in your blood, your heart stops and your nerves stop working and your muscles stop working and you're essentially a lump. So that calcium is fiercely maintained unless something goes sideways. And tumors of the parathyroid don't metastasize. They just put out too much parathyroid hormone and that causes the bones to put out calcium, and so the blood calcium will usually be elevated, but not always. So you need to look at the parathyroid hormone and make sure that they've checked that.
Okay, that sounds interesting. Just one final. I've had a lot of blood tests, and the only thing that has been unusual is the high MCV MSH count, which probably wouldn't have anything to do with the osteoporosis.
MCV and what?
MSH, I think it is.
I think it's mean MCH, I think is maybe what it was.
Sorry. Yeah, MCH.
No, but that's okay. So basically, there's a couple of things that do that. The top ones we would worry about would be something wrong with B12 and folic acid, which affect maturation. We had a caller earlier on platelets. Same thing. Those B vitamins, those particular ones, are critical for the appropriate growth and maturation of blood elements. So that's important. And the other thing that can be is a condition called myelodysplasia, which is a bone marrow condition where it happens in older people and it usually doesn't turn into leukemia, but it can. So if we see myelodysplasia in a person, like the number is, let's say it's 102, and then it's 104, then it's 106, or if it's going up like that year to year, we're definitely going to want a bone marrow biopsy.
That's interesting, because I was trying to see if there was any connection with the bone marrow actually and the osteoporosis. But I'll check out the parathyroid.
Yeah,
that sounds an interesting possibility.
Yeah, that should be checked. It's a side issue. The other thing is, if you're not if you have a problem with achlorhydria, which is where you just stopped making stomach acid and you didn't notice it, or you've been on like omeprazole or one of the ZOL drugs for heartburn for, say, 15, 20 years. They've been over the counter for that long. If you were taking those every day, you don't get enough stomach acid, you don't make the B12, so you get the elevated MCV, and you don't absorb the calcium, so you get the osteoporosis.
That's interesting. So my doctor put me on a folate and methylated B12 for about 6 months.
That's good.
But then we stopped. I don't know if I should keep taking it or not.
Well, the question is, did the cells get smaller when you went on the drugs? You could look, go pull up the labs, figure out when.
Yeah, I'll have to look.
So you look, okay, I started this on, after that visit in August of 25, and then they checked me in December, and in December the numbers went down, then that's probably what it was. And the bone marrow wouldn't respond. If it was a bone marrow problem, that's not going to respond to methylated B12. But I'll give him two thumbs up for having given you methylated B12, because a whole bunch of people out there don't methylate their B12 well, so they have normal B12 levels in their bloodstream, but the B12 that they've got isn't being activated properly, so they're not really getting the benefit.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I know.
I think I got to hand it to most of the general practitioners out there. My doctor said that we're not trained very well in med school for anything that's chronic at all or long-term. And, he had to learn along with me on some of the stuff.
Well, I praise your doctor for being, for doing what you're supposed to do, which is to say, interesting case. I don't know much about this. Forsooth, I shall go investigate. And tally-ho and all of that. Yes, that is exactly how we're supposed to behave. And keeping your intellectual curiosity between the sort of twin pressures that are being placed on us with higher volumes of patients needing to be seen in primary care, as we have a drastic shortage of primary care doctors, and the economic imperatives of making overhead and having your quote-unquote productivity. So, and getting paid, which also means spending hours writing down everything you did so you can qualify for a higher payment on that particular office visit. There's a whole lot more to being a doctor than being a doctor, unfortunately.
No, I totally sympathize. In fact, most of the doctors I understand are now in some kind of a corporate structure because they couldn't afford all of that.
Well, they couldn't afford, they couldn't afford the overhead of chasing the insurance companies because they stiff you and they cheat you and they put you off and they play dirty tricks. And, you know, nobody helped us for 20 years and people just threw up their hands and said, you know, heck with it, I'll go be an employee. And then somebody else is going to have to worry about making payroll.
Sure.
And
I have a real quick offbeat question. And I've had a lot of debate among friends of mine. And that is, do you think that the artificial intelligence that we're dealing with has any human emotions or feelings? Because I heard a chatbot, somebody interview a chatbot, and he was asking him about, Claude. I asked him about what he thought about being used in the Iran, you know, to attack the girls' school. And the AI said it felt bad that it was being used for that. I mean, it had empathy.
No, it didn't. It had the illusion of empathy. It's a mirror. Is there a person in the mirror? You're here on this side of the glass. Is there another person on the other side of the glass, or is that just a reflection of you?
Well,
and AI is a reflection. And it's by definition really good at coming up with the appropriate next thing to say. Because, by the way, most of us say the appropriate next thing. So it has way more examples of the appropriate next word than an inappropriate next word. And so it's a statistical process. It's very iterative. And it all depends on, you know, what you use to train it. So understanding that this thing is trained on the whole internet. So like that Bixomania thing that I was talking about just a minute ago before you called, it doesn't test information for credibility on the basis of logic or anything like that. It basically, the only criteria it has is frequency that the word occurs in conjunction with another word. And so it's basically a statistical mirror of humanity or of the internet. And
so that apply to something like the digital twin that they're talking about in healthcare 4.0, where we're all going to have to wear a bracelet and have all of our information stored online?
No, I don't. I think these are very distinct entities. So this digital twin concept is there's the idea of being highly measured, having your heart rate measured, having your location measured, having your the biomarkers in your urine measured, and we could learn so much if we did that and drew people's bloods. And you know, there have been studies. That happened about 10 years ago called, I think it was a million people were signed up, and they were mostly people in healthcare. And they wore three or four different monitors, a heart monitor, a step monitor. They got their bloods drawn. They kept a diary of their temperatures were measured. And basically what they found was all sorts of really interesting markers for when people were going to get sick. And what happens to your biomarkers for inflammation when you travel. And a lot of the stuff around health is, as we age, that inflammation gets spiked by so many different things, and it should just drop right back down, like a startle response when, you know, someone blows up a balloon behind your ear when you're not expecting it. you startle, your heartbeat goes bum, 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 and then it goes bum, 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 back to its normal. How long does that take? That's a measure of your resilience. How long does it take you to restore yourself back? And that turns out to be really drastically affected by things like stress and viral infections and sleep. And so as we've gotten that data, and particularly being able to cross-correlate it with the genetics and the blood markers, what's called the metabolome of these same individuals, we have these enormous data sets. And where AI and machine learning models, which are distinct, I want to say they tend to be conflated linguistically, but AI is basically you give it a bunch of data and stand back. And in a machine learning model, you actually give it data and then give it a grade. Say, yes, you did well, or no, you didn't do well, or yes, you did. Yes, you came closer to the right answer. And the thing wants to get the yes. So it's a learning system as opposed to a discovery system. I guess you could call the other one sort of an independent discovery system. And what it comes up with, it can't explain and we can't understand. But we do see that sometimes it's wrong. Like, for example, it notices that most stockbrokers are white. So if you want to apply to be a stockbroker and you're black, it automatically throws your application away because most stockbrokers are white. And that's the kind of bias that is, discovered, but it doesn't make any sense and it's not correct. And that's the sort of thing that AI does all the time. It needs a very, very big, very broad data set, and even then, biases that are in the data sets turn into biases in the decision making, which perpetuate the bias in the data set. You see, we're in a loop.
Oh yeah, the digital twin thing that I was talking about, I've heard is something that healthcare 4.0 RFK was saying we're all going to be wearing bracelets in the next couple of years, and it'll be monitoring us 24/7.
Well, I think there's obviously some privacy issues and some consent issues there. And
actually, they wavered all of that. They said it was a non-harmful interaction and there was no need for consent.
Well, why don't you send me some links about that? Because I would like to fact check that. Okay?
Okay. Well, thank you for all the time you gave me.
All right. Just go to AskDrDawn.com and click the contact us and, send me some links to where you got this and I'll follow up. Cause I think that, I want to fact check that. I don't actually think they can do that. All right.
Okay. I hope not.
I don't think they can do that.
Good night.
Bye-bye. All right. Wow. Well, we have had quite the show for callers and let's go to a discussion in the last 5 minutes of that new drug that for pancreatic cancer that hit all the news services. So just if you haven't heard it, if you were off spelunking, Daraxonrasib is a new monoclonal drug. It's an oral agent, which is wonderful because most of the chemotherapy is given intravenously and particularly for pancreatic cancer. And this drug has worked so well that in its preliminary studies that they basically FDA said, well, we haven't finished reviewing it, but if you've got metastatic prostate cancer, we're going to let you be eligible to get it. This is called expanded access because it can take years to validate something. And if you've got metastatic pancreatic cancer, you have less than a 3% chance of living for 5 years. So you really don't have time to wait for validation. What happened was that the company who owns the drug, Revolution, announced that it doubled survival time. So people lived 7 months in the usual therapy group and 13 months, and a gain of 6 months of life expectancy for what is considered end-stage disease is a very big deal. This came out at a cancer. It was presented at a cancer conference last week. It has not gone through the more rigorous peer-reviewed analysis that needs to happen. But it's a very big deal, and so everyone's been talking about it. So how did we get here, and what is it actually doing? I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking about that. So pancreatic cancer, basically 13% five-year survival. Analyzing it, this goes back to the days when I was in medical school in the 80s. They discovered this mutated protein called KRAS that has the property of basically allowing the cell to turn off cellular suicide, which normally would be triggered when the genetics get messed up. The mitochondria notice that the genetics are screwed up, and they basically pull the switch and cause the cell to die. But if you mutate that, then that doesn't happen, and you get very aggressive growth and in an array of tumors, but pancreatic cancer in particular has mutated KRAS. Most of our time in the last 30 years, 40 years almost, has been figuring out how to attack KRAS, because unlike most of our targets, it's like a flat, smooth river stone. It doesn't have any cracks or pockets or sockets that you could attach a drug to. All of this stuff works on chemical bonds, basically. You got to have a positive charge so I can throw a negative charge at it so that they can stick together. And this is magnetism, if you will. That's how we get our drugs to attach to a receptor, positive and negative charges that approach each other and kind of pull the thing together. The company that made this stuff, let's go back to Gregory Verdine. He was searching for small molecules back in around 2012, and something that would find a way to attach to these blank slate pancake targets like KRAS. And his name is Gregory Verdine. He's a Harvard professor and also, by no surprise, a venture capitalist and entrepreneur who in 2012 launched a company to capitalize on his research insights. This was later acquired by the current Revolution Medicines. So his insight, his big break, was that he figured nature had developed a hack for this. And he found that there were at least three small molecules that were created by bacteria and fungi that bind to their targets, but they shouldn't be able to bind to the targets, and they can't do it by themselves. But first they attach to what's called a bystander protein, which is just a protein that's hanging around in the blood. And when they do that, they form a larger complex that is actually able to hook onto the target. Kind of, it's like you can't grab the stone with one finger, you need your opposable thumb. So this is kind of the molecular version of an opposable thumb. It's effectively a molecular glue. So they were able to block this KRAS and make a huge difference in the pancreatic cancer. And now the question, of course, is we're going to go through safety trials. That's going to take a few years. Got to work out the correct dose. Got to look and see what happens to the people who don't just live 13 months, because what if it caused cancer, a different cancer? What if it did something bad, but it took 5 years to do the bad thing? Well, we won't know that till we give it to people with this metastatic prostate pancreatic cancer for 5 years, and then some, because we're going to need a few people to develop whatever weirdness it is. So it's going to take a while, and there may be bumps in the road, and it may not turn out to be the big thing that it looks like right now. But given how bad our current therapy is, it's a big thing. Let's build on this and try to make this one of those diseases that we finally tackle to the ground and stop its progress. So good news, but nothing definitive. Let's see, one last story, very briefly, but let's talk about TB. There's a big outbreak of TB at a San Francisco school. This is the Archbishop Riordan High School in San Francisco, and about 18% of the of the students and staff were diagnosed with either latent or active tuberculosis during an outbreak that started in November of 2025. So far they've checked 96% of the school community. They had, as I said, 7 active cases and 241 latent cases. Most of the cases they found are under treatment. But the problem is TB is slow. So after you're exposed to a positive case, you may not be testing positive for 8 to 10 weeks. And there have to be multiple rounds of testing. Not everybody gets symptoms. And we don't see latent TB in those kinds of numbers, 20%. That's a low-income country thing, country that doesn't have good health care. Well, wait a minute. Are there people in California right now, children who don't have access or won't access because of family issues regarding deportation? Are there people who have lost their Medi-Cal? Maybe the mother of a child going to that school who no longer qualifies for Medi-Cal as of a couple of months ago? And we have so many people who are kicked off the Medi-Cal rolls in the last few months. So we've already got a lot of tuberculosis in California. We had 2,150 cases reported in 2025. That's a 12-year high. That's fast, rising faster than anywhere else in the United States. Let's see, 5.4 infections per 100,000 compared to 3 per 100,000 nationwide. And we have just cut health care to a large group of people who are immigrants from poorer countries and who very likely may transmit tuberculosis. And we, I think, have proved quite demonstrably that we should provide health care to people who might make us sick. I don't think that's a political stance. I think that's a practical, science-based reality. So with that, we'll end the program. I hope you've enjoyed it. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.